This is SBS Spice.
Welcome back to SBS Spice. This is Suhaila Sharif. The core to many classic love stories has been passion, conflict, and resilience. In an age where many love stories have started with a swipe or fizzled as situationships, the love story that has gripped Indian-born, Melbourne-based playwright and activist lawyer Danish Sheikh powerfully is his own with the law. Spanning decades and countries, Danish has had his heart broken by the law, but healing has also been fueled by constitutional, judicial, and creative progress. As a theatrical storyteller, Danish has been able to creatively share his experiences on stage by blending comedy, drama, and even the teachings of renowned relationship philosopher Taylor Swift. As his latest on-stage courtroom drama, Much to Do with Law, But More to Do with Love, is set to captivate audiences for Midsummer 2026 in Melbourne, he sits down with me to explore the next chapter of his love story with the law. Danish, please tell our listeners, how did your love story with the law begin?
Thanks, Suhaila. So it really starts when I am fairly young, so this must have been around the age of 17, and I saw this image of these lawyers in the newspaper, and it was an image of them outside the courtroom, and they had just, at that point, filed a petition to challenge the sodomy law in India. So the law that criminalized homosexuality. And it was a pretty, it was an interesting moment because it was also a time when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. I was starting to realize that I was gay. And I was also starting to then realize that being gay made me a criminal under the law. So it was a lot of really complicated feelings all at the same time. And then I see this image, you know, of these lawyers in the paper, and they are fighting a battle against this very law that criminalizes my existence. And so I thought, well, I think that's it. Like, I just have to go to law school and I have to do this thing. And, you know, for me, it was just like the law was a kind of word magic. You know, because one of the things that lawyers do is they use these words on the written page and they creatively employ those words to craft new realities into existence, right? Like what these lawyers were doing, for example, was they were saying that, yeah, we have this colonial law. This is a law that, you know, has been in existence from 1860. So it's a British imposition. And yes, you might say that's part of the legal framework. But we have something else that's part of the Indian legal framework, and that's the Constitution of India. And the Constitution of India is a document that was drafted at the time of freedom from colonial rule. It was drafted to imagine an India that would unshackle itself from the repression of the colonial era. And it contains this really beautiful rights language about the right to privacy, personal liberty, the right to life. And if we are to take those values seriously as Indian values, then we cannot take this other law which criminalizes a large segment of the Indian community as well. And so it's sort of like two versions of reality, both crafted by words. And the lawyers were saying that this one version of reality is the one that should invalidate the other. And for me, that was just absolute magic.
Thank you for also providing the background. I feel like many of our listeners who are based in Australia may not know about the history and how deeply ingrained it is and how it still impacted people till 2018 when Section 377 was overturned. I would love to know now, when did theatre come into the picture?
Yeah, so as much as, you know, I was infatuated and enamored by the law, when I did start working in a law firm just after I graduated from law school in 2011, we joined this litigation to decriminalize homosexuality. And so theater came into the fray at a moment when I was starting to lose hope with the law. And so it was a moment of extreme heartbreak. So in 2013, the Indian Supreme Court ruled that actually LGBT persons constituted a minuscule minority, that we were too small in number to actually warrant a change in the legal framework of the country. And they said that the sodomy law, Section 377, did not violate the so-called rights of LGBT persons. And I'm quoting from the judgment here, right? So this was, you know, it was hard enough to read as a queer person, but it was even harder to read as a queer lawyer. as someone who had cared for the law and had loved the law. And so that was a moment in where I just had this crisis of faith. And I said, this institution for now is something I need to step away from. But I also need to make sense of what has happened here. And so I turned to the theater. And the thing that I did was I looked at all these exchanges that we'd had in the courtroom for years at that point between the lawyers and the judges. And they formed these transcripts that ran into hundreds of thousands of pages. And I wanted to edit them down into a theatrical piece that would show people just how not reasonable and how not rational and how not neutral the law can be, right? So it was just to say, you think that these judges have made some sort of principled stance in saying that queer people should continue to be criminalized, but I'm going to show you through theater that that's not the case at all. And I'm not going to editorialize. I'm not going to add any commentary. I will just let them speak for themselves, right? So that was a really important moment of recovering my voice in some ways. And I think that's what theater allowed me to do. It allowed me to find a different way to speak about the law and find a way to challenge it at a point where one forum had failed. And so it was about bringing it into the court of public opinion and saying that here's something else that we can do. And then that led to a whole bunch of conversations really about, you know, what does it mean to practice law differently? What does it mean to practice law through an emotional lens? What does it mean to bring your whole selves into law? Because one of the other stereotypes about lawyers, and the thing with stereotypes is that they're not untrue, they're just incomplete. And so, you know, so you talk about the legal shark, the super sort of like pragmatic, rational lawyer. And that's partly true, right? And so it's one of the things that I was also trying to say with the theater that I was creating was that you don't have to let go of that part of yourself that is emotional, that cares, that feels. And bringing that into the courtroom might actually make us better lawyers. And those stakes are huge, right? Because ultimately what we need to do is then try and get the judges to connect with the story that we're trying to tell. And trying to get the judges to stop separating this emotional part of themselves with the part that's the rational self. And so something like that actually then does happen in 2018 when the Indian Supreme Court finally decriminalizes homosexuality. And it's a really emotional judgment. There's these really beautiful lines about what it means to love and what it means to live under the shadow of the law. So you can see that they're clearly moved by the testimony that the lawyers have presented before them. And so there are consequences to this.
That kind of builds into my next question of the reception to when you first stepped onto the stage and started creating theater. I mean, forgive me for my judgment. I don't have much experience with law, but I feel like it's based on structure. And what happens is when my assumption to structure is it's removed from emotion, but theater kind of reinstates that emotion back into the stories that are seen in courtrooms. What was your audience's reaction like to your work and your theater work that portrayed these stories?
There were two kinds of reactions. One was a sense of surprise and outrage at getting an insight into what the judges actually said inside the courtroom and the way in which the judges seemed to think of LGBT persons, right? Because till that point, there had been some sense of thinking, oh, well, maybe it was just a matter of this case not being strong enough, right? Or you think about the law as this set of propositions, and if you prove the proposition, you win the case. And then you hear the judges say certain things about queer persons. So one of the most crucial moments for me in this entire litigation was when one of the lawyers from our side read out the testimony of a transgender woman. And it's a brutal story of sexual assault. And it's read out in full before the court. And the judges hear it. And there's a pause for a few seconds. And then their question is, yes, but how do we know this happened? And it was a strange response because, A, that was a really famous case. But also there was a lot of testimony, a lot of contemporaneous evidence to support that. So it was a strange question to ask, moving it to the point of evidence, as opposed to just trying to understand how the law perpetuated the system or the sexual assault that this person faced. But yeah, I think when we stage that moment for a public audience, there's a sense of shock at the judicial apathy, the judicial inability to listen. There's a difference between just giving people a hearing and actually listening to what they're saying. And so this is one thing that kind of comes out there. The other thing that came out, which was also quite, I would say, rewarding for me, is that a lot of young students from university who were either considering going to law school or were thinking of otherwise engaging with the law saw the show. And they found it to be a really exciting kind of challenge in some ways. They saw the show, and this is absolutely what I think of the show, that show is doing, and also this particular show that I'm now presenting and Midsommar is doing. It's about saying that the law is not this monolithic entity, that we all have a role to play in challenging and remaking it, regardless of who we are, regardless of what our institutional location is. And so it's giving that sense of agency back to people and saying that we can and we should be creative in how we interpret and how we live with law. And so that was really lovely.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but grassroots activism is what kind of empowered the change in 2018. It's what helped it overthrow Section 377. It was stories, it was people, it was resistance, it was power, just like being together. I think that's exactly what I'm kind of getting out of here, is people coming to terms with that power after seeing that visibility on stage.
You're with SBS Spice.
The law is built on structure and having these set out ways of approaching society. Theatre provides this freedom of expression and just, you know, being unfiltered and being yourself on stage. What has been your experience intertwining both?
Absolutely. So one of the really great things that does happen with theatre is that it allows you to present these other propositions that don't neatly align, right? Because you're right, theatre doesn't have to be rational in the way that law needs to be rational. And so what that has done for me with this new work is allow people to feel the sensation of uncertainty. And I think uncertainty is a really important value to feel right now, because one of the things that happens in an incredibly polarized world is that we have a set of assumptions and viewpoints. And when you get into the algorithm and when you get into the bubble effect that social media does, the one thing that happens to the opinions that you have is that they keep getting reified over and over. And obviously, there is a certain kind of value in holding steadfast your opinions. But something does happen where you where your ability to be unsettled and your ability to listen to the other starts whittling away. And so one thing that I've found that theater as a genre, and this show in particular, does is it keeps pressing and challenging those assumptions. So you think you're watching one thing in the show and you completely buy into this protagonist's viewpoint of how things should be. And then you find that the ground is unsettled. And then you switch on to that other standpoint. And then once again, the ground is unsettled, right? And that happens with everything in the show. So you might think this show is an ode to Taylor Swift, but it becomes something a lot more complicated than that. And what that is, I won't reveal, but yes.
Very interesting. What year did you move to Australia?
I moved in 2019 to do my PhD at the Melbourne Law School.
Oh, fantastic. So since moving to Australia, to Melbourne in 2019, what have you observed in terms of the acceptance of the queer community in Australia in comparison to maybe your life in India?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Sohaila, because, you know, in many ways, I feel like I lived a fairly relatively privileged existence in India because, you know, I was in a milieu of progressive lawyers, academics, artists. So those are all spaces where, you know, people are very attuned to queerness. People are fairly free to be open. And then, of course, in 2018, homosexuality does get decriminalized. So a whole year before I move. And so I think I had a sense or had an idea of what it means to live free. But then you move to Melbourne and you move to a place where homosexuality has been decriminalized for so many decades now, right? And so, and you start experiencing a different sense of what freedom means. So, you know, one of the most remarkable experiences I've had has been the Midsommar Street Party, which is the thing that ends the Midsommar Festival each year in Melbourne. And there is something so beautiful about just having these entire streets just taken over by queer persons for the entire day, completely unapologetically, and just a celebration of queer joy and dancing that spills out onto the streets. And, you know, I've experienced something similar when it comes to pride marches in India, but those have always felt, and they always did feel like extremely protected spaces. You were always very wary of the police presence around you. And so it is, I do feel very grateful for the privilege to feel that sense of freedom here, you know, to be able to kiss my partner on a public street. At the same time, that's not to say that this freedom is completely free, right? So there have been instances, either when I've been with my partner, where I've absolutely felt challenged, either verbally or through someone's kind of gestures of discomfort. And this is in, you know, the central business district of Melbourne, so in a very kind of otherwise seemingly visible space. And then there have been instances where I've experienced my brownness playing a certain kind of role in queer spaces, right? So yeah, I think there's always going to be different kinds of challenges.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is a step forward? How do we make it so that these experiences, especially when you think about intersectionality, can be acknowledged in a way where there is progress? So what do you think is the step forward? What do you think progress is fueled by here in Australia?
I think storytelling is one of the most important ways forward. And this is not just an act of self-promotion, but, you know, I will say that there is something to be said for stories that feature front and center complicated migrant narratives, complicated narratives of people of color, where it's not just primarily a story about loss and a story about violation, but it's also these stories where you get an insight into what it means to experience the world as a brown person, as a migrant, the specific forms of insight that can give you. Because I do think that I feel very, very privileged to have the sense of what I call migrant vision, which is the ability to live in two worlds at the same time and to constantly always be looking inwards and outwards. And I think that allows for a certain way of noticing things that, you know, I think otherwise go unnoticed. And I think that's what my art hopes to bring to people. And I think we just need so much more of that, so much more storytelling by brown creators, by migrant creators.
I think visibility is like such a core part of creating change, right? And that's the perfect segue into much to do with law, but more to do with love, which is your upcoming theatre work that is being showcased at Midsummer 2026. It actually won the 2025 Queer Playwriting Award at Midsummer 2025, and that was based off a 20-minute excerpt itself. It is really powered by documentation of queer stories and using contemporary artifacts to bring forth the courtroom drama, as well as sprinkling in Taylor Swift. But talk to me about, you know, what went into creating this work and what you have envisioned for its future beyond the courtroom drama itself.
One of the things that I was interested in with this work was, you know, now we're at a point where these legal battles are done. Right. So the battle to decriminalize homosexuality in India is done. We've all kind of moved on. The year it was decriminalized, the year after that, I moved to Australia and I started doing a PhD. And it's kind of a reflective exercise in some ways, passing through each of these moments. And then I kind of realized that each of these moments in the past, the moment where I realized I was a queer criminal, the moment where I began law school, the moment where I decided I wanted to be a human rights lawyer, the moment where I lost in the courtroom, the moment where I became a playwright, each of these were distinct eras. Each of these were distinct
Love.
Moments.
Love.
And yeah, like, who's doing an interesting take on the idea of eras, right? Who could that be?
Do I hear Eras Tour right now? Is that the vibe I'm getting? Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. And so basically this show is my Eras Tour. It's in conversation with Taylor Swift's eras, and it's talking about what I find that she does that's really interesting, whether you like her or you hate her. And let's acknowledge it, right? Taylor Swift is a very polarizing figure right now, and that makes sense. It's sort of like she's a billionaire pop star, right? You don't get to that point without a lot of people having very strong opinions about you. But what she does that I think is interesting is the ability to say, I have these past lives. I was a country singer at this point, and then I made this foray into huge maximal pop. And then I experimented with rap, I guess. And then I became a folk singer-songwriter. And what the Eras Tour does is it says all of those things are significant, right? All of those things matter. I'm going to give you this 3.5-hour spectacular experience where I say, you know, that kid, that country singer that I was at 17, sits on the same plane as this singer-songwriter who gave us this pandemic album of solace and comfort in 2020 with Folklore. And I think there's something really interesting there as a message in terms of what does it mean to learn from and honor your past selves, your past eras, and think with them in the present moment? Because we have this tendency to compartmentalize otherwise, right? And I'm just kind of trying to resist that.
Well, this is like such a sweet note to end on, because I would love to know Danish in his era today, in his theater era today, what would that Danish say to the country singing Danish who maybe started off his law journey? And what kind of reflection have you made to then look back and be like, you know, this is what I want to say to that self?
Cherish your sense of vulnerability and openness. And that is going to be your greatest strength. So the ability to read books and look at movies and change the genders of the protagonists in your mind as you try to find a companion to your confusion and a mirror to your reality that at this point feels extremely lonely. But you do this vulnerable thing and you feel so strongly, you young 17-year-old, hold on to those feelings because those feelings matter and those feelings are what will let you make hopefully good art, but also just as importantly, good law. And those two things for me are inseparable.
Oh, that's so sweet. I have no doubt that 17-year-old Danish would be very proud of 36-year-old Danish as well. So this was such a pleasure. And I'm so glad I got to chat to you. For our listeners, Much to Do with Law, but More to Do with Love will be showcasing at Midsummer 2026 in the start of February. Danish, thank you so much for chatting to me for SBS Spice.
Thank you so much, Suhaila, for having me.
For more hot takes from South Asians in Australia, find and follow SBS Spice on Instagram at SBS Spice or on YouTube by searching for SBS South Asian. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button.